The Gambling Files Podcast, the podcast that doesn't touch itself when it thinks of you. Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files Podcast, an exciting episode where we talk to somebody about some stuff, but not just any somebody. We talk to our new insect overlords. Fintan, you're here. Hello.
Hello, John. So we can't keep referring to people as insect overlords. It's not.
But it shows respect.
It doesn't, though. I don't think it does. It doesn't seem friendly.
Really?
Yeah. It doesn't seem the friendliest. Like, do you really want to be called an insect? Overlord, fine. Our new overlords, but insect overlords, I think we could.
But insects are awesome.
I'm not a big fan of insects, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but I mean, they are pretty spectacular things.
Are they though?
Yeah, you look at the way that ants work together and termites, that kind of thing. I mean, they're incredible.
Yeah, but if like they're in your house, you're not exactly delighted, right? Like if you've got termites in your house, are you like, oh, these are fucking awesome. This is great. No, you're not. You're fucking furious.
Never alone with a termite, man, Fintan.
You're never alone. You've always got a friend.
Exactly. You might not get on with the first termite, but you're going to get on with one of the other several million.
True. So anyway, our new overlords.
All right. So we've got new overlords.
But they're lovely. So it's actually fine.
Are they though?
They are. The Czech spirit, so they're really good. They're my favorite.
Yeah, they're certainly in my top two. But it is our first episode with them, so it's kind of a slightly specialized episode as a result, because they have a specialism. Fintan, what is their specialism? What's their name? Bring it. I'm putting you on the spot here.
You are, because you know I'm dyslexic. It's a series of letters and numbers. Hey, Isaac. It is GRS Recruit. That is GRS-recruit.com. Not to be confused with any fucking...
And any companies that have a similar name.
Any kind of like, yeah, fake off-brand shit recruitment. This is proper gambling-specific industry veterans. They've done your job. They've been dealers. They know what it's like on the floor. They've worked their way through the systems. Been there, done that. Get you the right candidates. What was the quote Paul used? Particularly for the senior stuff. We know everyone. Or if we don't know them, we know somebody who knows them. Which is, you know.
Exactly. I just remember when he said, take me to the sugar mines.
So I think that's what you want in a recruitment agent, I don't know what they call themselves.
But it's an interesting chat.
It is.
We talk about the current problems, the way that the roles kind of mutated in the last 2-3 years.
Yeah.
And share shit experiences from interviews.
Yeah. And things employers can do better. Things potential employees could do better.
I was disappointed to hear that you know, people still do shit like, you know, like if you've applied for something and you've gone through the process and then you don't turn up for the interview and stuff like that. It's just like,
oh yeah. I was thinking about it afterwards. I remember I did one interview and I asked the guy, like, why did you apply for this job? And he goes, well, completely different industry even. Well, your recruiter contacted me on LinkedIn. And here I am. And he goes, so what do you know about us as a company, or what kind of attracted you to make it, you know, worth your while coming in? And he goes, I've got no idea. I'm just here because I got a LinkedIn message.
Do you think he thought he was being headhunted and that you were totally into him?
for junior staff, when they get that first LinkedIn message from a recruiter and they've been headhunted, they do get very flattered and kind of caught up in the moment. And I've definitely had to sit a few people down going, they've sent that message to 200 people. You're not that special.
Have you ever been headhunted, like proper?
Like fucking gorillas in the mist kind of thing.
My God, that took a dark twist.
I'm just what was it during the Thomas Cook when he hit the islands and they called the sailors long pigs because they'd never seen kind of like such pink skin before. So the cannibals were like, you know, fine, we'll eat these guys. No, I've never been headhunted on like a physical level. No, I've definitely been. Yes, is the short answer. Several times.
Yeah, you have to be modest about it.
I have several times, but then also, like I talk about on the interview, I had a bunch of LinkedIn tricks that made it like I took my marketing knowledge and applied it to my life, which is why I was critiquing your bike salesmanship,
which sold the next day.
But I don't know, John. I think you could have sold it for more. I was a little bit
shocked by eBay's charge.
How much?
12.8%.
Oh yeah. Plus, then if they paid with PayPal, PayPal's taken a fee. It's rough.
So that was a little surprise. So I got dicked. He got a bargain.
Yeah.
But this may come as a surprise, but I haven't been headhunted.
Really?
Yeah.
Or we're going to fix that. Give me your LinkedIn password.
Shall we fix it in the episode after this one?
I think we should. Big week, John. Big week.
It's a big week. So we chat to Paul Skelfer about the world of recruitment and, as Fenton says, Paul, I mean, he's been around in the gambling industry for a long time. He's got a wealth of experience and he's an interesting chap.
Yep.
So it's well worth a listen. I can't think of any good jokes that I've heard. And I know that Fenton has to go onto some meeting or some shit because
I'm a busy, important executive.
He's a busy, important executive. He's just being modest now. There's a lot of modesty in you, Fenton. You should be bigging yourself up more. You should be strutting in the room.
Mate, if this ego is any bigger, it'll have its own gravitational pull. I think it's fine.
See, you say that, like, but I've never been a chairman. I've never been headhunted. But I think it's fair to say that my confidence levels are reasonably high. Can you imagine what they'd be like? If I got a recruiter message on LinkedIn or something, I'd be like, "Wait, you know, I'd be strutting down the street like friggin' Han Solo. Well, maybe not Han Solo, maybe Chewbacca, maybe Leia, maybe R2-D2. To be fair, actually,
it's C-3PO. That's got the.
I was going to say, I get really stiff these days, so yeah, I think it'd probably be C-3PO. Yeah, I think
did you ever hear the Star Wars fiction, the fan theory that C-3PO and R2-D2 are actually Sith?
I did not hear that theory.
So, or basically, because they're in every kind of major thing, and it's like the Master and the Apprentice. And there's a whole theory that they're actually the dark side.
Yeah, but that would imply that George Lucas knew what he was doing.
And he didn't.
He really, really didn't.
The new ones, if you've watched them, if you actually like the, I've been watching my son, the Bad Batch, the cartoon, the new series of it, brilliant.
I've hardly watched any of the new stuff.
Cartoon series, so the Clone Wars.
Well, Clone Wars was like the last really good thing that I remember.
Is it the Clone Wars? There was a cartoon series. Was it the Clone Wars?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the Clone Wars was brilliant, and then the Bad Batch is a spin-off of the Clone Wars cartoon, and that's absolutely top-notch storytelling.
Yeah,
for the Star Wars universe.
Sure it is, but you know, I just can't be asked anymore.
Fair enough.
It's too much. It's too much. Too many things.
Too much content.
Yeah, so there doesn't have to be 16 series associated with all these things.
True.
Although I did enjoy She-Hulk Attorney at Law.
I was showing, like, it sounds like one of those kind of throwback ones. I was showing my son yesterday. So he's in a swimming club, and the swimming club's called the Dolphins, but in Dutch. And I was making like a flipper joke of like, you know, I'm going to show up to one of your swim meets one day in like a full dolphin outfit and just make like kind of noises. And he's like, what's that noise? I'm like, oh, it's a dolphin. And it's like Flipper. And he's like, what Flipper? So I showed him like the trailer for Flipper. And then we went down the rabbit hole. So if you show him Flipper, you've also got to show him Skippy, the bush kangaroo.
Yeah, Gentle Ben.
Oh, I forgot about Gentle Ben. I remember Lassie. So Lassie the dog. I forgot about Gentle Ben. So we went through the whole things. But the trailer for Flipper was that old, you know, that really old school announcer voice, and like they introduced the wife as like the good looking wife and all this kind of stuff. Like, it's just proper old Hollywood type scenario.
Yeah.
But yeah, Flipper.
That just reminded me of something. And I'll keep this short because I know you're busy and important. You know, you're talking about like descriptions of people. Something you just said just triggered this memory. So there are these books that I collect, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've sort of stopped collecting them these days because the internet makes it too easy.
Okay.
But they're basically, when I was a kid.
Are they specialist publications?
They are highly specialized.
There's an entire corner of the internet dedicated to that, mate.
When I was about, God, I don't know, about 7 or 8, something like that, Mum used to get me books from jumble sales, you know, was a thing back in the day. And she bought me a couple of books back the one day. In fact, it was 3 books, right? And I've still got all 3 of them. It was a book called The Unwilling Adventurers by a guy called Paul Buddy. And he's an Australian teacher turned author.
Mm-hmm.
It was The Giant Under the Snow by John Gordon, which may still be the best children's book I've ever read.
Okay.
And a very peculiar little book called Change for Charlwood. And even at that age, I thought it was friggin' hilarious. And I've read it multiple times in the years since, and it gets funnier every time. And what it is, and I only later found this out when I started finding books by the same publisher, it was an evangelical press in the UK. And they printed books that were basically given away as prizes at Sunday schools.
Nice.
So it was kind of your classic boys and girls adventure stories.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Very thinly veiled Christian propaganda.
Nice.
They're amazing. I've got probably about 80 of them.
Really?
They're phenomenal, but the very best ones, the peak ones, are the ones that are aimed at teens.
Birds and the Bees type stuff?
Change for Charlwood is one of them. It's brilliant. This guy moves to this little village where there's nothing to do, but there are some young toughs. But who's that guy playing cricket? He's really good. Surely he can't be a vicar. He's too cool. It's fabulous. But there are vocational ones. And there's one, I can't remember the name of it. It's Michael something, Police Cadet. But my very, very favorite was Shirley Baldwin, Sales Assistant. And it's basically kids going into apprenticeships and shit like that and finding their way in the world kind of thing.
Nice.
And finding God.
Nice.
Shirley Baldwin finds God in her handbag. It's one of the greatest things I've ever read in my life. The publisher is still going. I've contacted them. Even they don't have a list of their books. They don't know what they've put out there, so I can't even get a complete. It's awesome. I'll lend you some.
Thanks.
But anyway, Fenton, very busy, very important. Paul Sculfer, very interesting. Our new overlord.
There we go.
Enjoy the episode.
Pleasure.
We join our first guest today. The term industry legend is used a lot, not usually in relation to this man. We're joined by Paul Scalfa, Director of Gaming Recruitment Solutions, our new Insect Overlords. Paul, welcome.
Thanks very much. Good to be here. Good to meet you guys.
Well, yeah, thanks for coming. But we are going to have a serious discussion, but, you know, before that, let's have a little bit of history. You've been in the casino industry for a long time.
I have, yes. First time for a while, I think, that I've been the oldest person involved in this podcast. I started out in 1989 in betting shops as a Saturday settler, which was it was a great weekend job. Then loved the industry, went to college, did my dissertation about gambling, and then got into casinos and never looked back. Started out as a dealer in Southampton, got onto like a management scheme for Rank, went through Grosvenor Casinos in operations and then head office and, you know, a variety of different roles, and been self-employed now for 15 years. Started out as a self-employed consultant, and then since then myself and my partner Stephen Jackson started GRS as a recruitment company about 9 years ago, and been going ever since. So it's I don't know how to do anything else other than gambling. That's all I've ever done.
I think you and I first met when you opened Aspers Newcastle.
I have opened a bunch of casinos. I arrived at Newcastle just after it opened, about 9 months in. But I was working up there, running bingo clubs. The opportunity came up, and I jumped at it. It was a great job in a lot of ways. Very challenging. I was, to be honest, probably too young to be running a site that big. It's a kind of experience that stands you in good stead. It's a big old site, still going now. They're on about their 15th general manager now. But they're good guys.
When they you know, in that first year of opening, certainly, and probably for the first few years, that restaurant was indescribably good.
It really was.
So Finton, picture this. Centre of Newcastle, yep. in a development called The Gate.
That's right, yeah.
And it's a big, like, entertainment destination, and there's this Aspers Casino in it. And it's a really nice casino. It's beautifully done out. But, you know, it's an entertainment destination in Newcastle. So sounds a lot like, of people in T-shirts all year round, et cetera, you know.
Sounds like grey crack, to be honest with you.
But I'm Irish. It's in Newcastle, so the last thing you need is to invest in coat hooks, for example.
Sure.
It's outside of probably the private London clubs, Aspers Newcastle was my best casino dining experience in the UK.
What'd you get?
Possible exception of the Hippodrome, because of course they've got the Heliot Steakhouse, which is just fucking brilliant. They did a tuna steak there, right? Which was actually, it was more like a tuna breeze block. It was like, no shit, it was like this, and like it was this big square, but somehow it was cooked beautifully. I mean, it was like proper chefing. It was really, really good.
They've since moved away from the top end cuisine on the basis that not enough people wanted it. But I do remember it wasn't long after I was there that they changed gears. But I had a meal there on my birthday, and this sounds quite menacing in retrospect. The chef, whose name is Tony, cooked up some special sauce just for me. I know. On reflection, thinking about it, well, it still tasted good. Anyway, I've never tasted anything like it. I still talk about it to this day. It was peppercorn sauce, hand reduced. And it was sensational. On reflection. Anyway.
And now it was a tremendous experience. But I have, in fact, dined there since. And as you say, they have changed the proposition. Yeah. But that makes sense, because it's in an entertainment destination in Newcastle. It's not in a high-end dining destination in Newcastle. It's all ends of the demographic kind of, you know, the Gate's just like bouncing on the weekends.
Yeah, it's typical of every casino outside London in the UK. I think the game is to try and appear just posh enough that people will come and book for a meal in there while really serving food that's cooked by people on minimum wage or thereabouts. You can't afford to offer fine dining. The real posh casino restaurants date back to when it was all you could advertise. You couldn't advertise the casino, but you could advertise the restaurant. So that's why they tended to be. And now there's still some exceptions. You go to Manchester 235, they've got a partnership with James Martin there, I think, and that's sensational. Yes. But it's more like two leisure destinations in the same building.
That's the thing. If you look at where the restaurant's sited in the context of the casino there, the restaurant has all the windows and all that, and it's really cleverly done, actually.
Yeah. Same in Nottingham. They've got the Marco Pierre White site there. Separate entrance. It's got its own separate address. So the idea is people go in there. I think the idea is for the Alia, this is go in there to eat because they want to have a Marco Pierre White steak and see the casino next door and kind of drift in. But I think you have to look at it as two separate businesses.
Makes sense. You've been around a long time. Yeah. And now you're a director at Gaming Recruitment Solutions and New Insect Overlords. And I, for one, welcome them. Fintan was just saying earlier that he will help you to recruit workers for your sugar mines.
I did. No problems. As a trusted gambling podcast co-host.
That's it. What could possibly go wrong? But no, so it's not just about, I mean, you are Overlord, as mentioned, but we wanted to talk to you because we wanted to talk, and we have spoken to a couple of recruitment people here and there over the past sort of 12 months. But it's a really, really interesting time to be in recruitment, to be looking for a job, to be thinking your job shit and be looking around for something else. Because things have changed a lot. I mean, it's, I guess your role, have you ever seen anything like the way it's been the last 12 months? And it's changing again now. Times are crazy, Paul.
They are. It's bonkers. But yeah, the last 12 months have been, obviously COVID threw everyone in a variety of ways, but just the candidate power now, I don't think, going back before we had GRS and to my work history and to yours as well, there's no equivalent to how much the power is in the candidate's hands now. We get clients who've, or we've had people over the years who will take, 3 months to complete a recruitment process, and it just doesn't fly anymore. If you've got, decent professionals who are well respected in what they do, they just aren't going to wait that long. And if they're, a month into a process, if it's not moving forward, they'll have other offers on the table. You have to be, it's not a question of, posting on LinkedIn about your company culture and how great you are. You have to actually act. If you don't keep things moving, then just people will leave you behind. It's great. Probably from a state of the market standpoint, it's a good thing that candidates have a bit more power and that you can't treat them like you would in 1980. But it certainly makes life more difficult when you get a client who's a bit on the inflexible side or a bit on the kind of bureaucratic side. And we've got one process going on now for a senior role, which has been going on because one of the candidates messaged me yesterday, 111 days so far. It's just by happenstance that he's still involved in the process. If he had another offer, if it wasn't a job he really wanted, he'd be gone. And I think the same goes across the business at middle management, the senior levels. You just got to be a bit more respectful.
Yeah. I mean, Fintan, of the two of us, Fintan is very senior and very important in his role.
Fucking doesn't feel like that today.
Give it time. The day's not over yet. But it's interesting. I mean, like, what you're saying about the time thing, what's quite interesting there is you could almost, if you're a bit of a cheeky kind of an MD type, chairman type, you could be like, oh, I'm going to drag this out for like 4 months and we'll get to the end and there'll be like one candidate left standing and I won't want them because nobody else wants them. I want you to go back to the first guy who got hired straight away because he's obviously really good.
Well,
would that work?
It wouldn't be great for us, but we do get that. I mean, there's plenty of times we'll get to the end of a process and either whoever's left isn't appropriate or isn't suitable or there's a reason why they can't do a deal and you've got to start again. But that's just part of the game. We're used to it. We like to think And we certainly like to say that we do things the right way, you know, in the sense of the objective is to find the right person who's going to do a great job and ideally last for a while. Having said that, you know, everyone I think accepts is portfolio careers now. And when you're recruiting, if you get someone and they stick for 5 years, you've had a fantastic result. They do a great job.
And in terms of the drawn out recruitment process, how much of that is just bureaucratic systems versus they didn't really sit down before they started, they didn't really sit down and think about what they wanted and the types of skills they wanted?
It's definitely both, but there's a linking factor. I think it tends to be in the bigger companies, the more levels that you've got involved in the decision, the more complicated it gets. Because if you're an operational manager and this person's going to be working for you, but your director wants a say in it, the chance of pinning your director down to discuss the job spec is almost nil. They just haven't got time for that. They're not interested. They want to meet the candidate halfway through the process for the minimum of fuss. And that's the problem. If you've got multiple layers, and in where we really get problems is when there's three or four layers involved. You've got the hiring manager, their boss, the HR team, and then maybe someone senior wants to get involved as well. And no one except for the hiring manager is interested in the detail. So before you know it, you know, you get halfway through the process and someone senior says, "Well, this isn't the kind of person we want, or this isn't the role that we need." And then you start again. And we kind of try to avoid those kind of clients. But the bigger they are, luckily in some ways for us, the really big companies have their own recruitment teams and they don't tend to use us unless there's a role that's either senior enough that it would be inappropriate for their internal team to do it, or someone's about to get fired and they want to pre-hire a replacement, which does happen from time to time. Which is a difficult situation.
But I've definitely seen situations where I remember I was hiring for a web designer, right. And the company had a policy of you had to do a personality test,
right,
and an IQ test.
Wow.
All right. And it was your classic kind of like you know, verbal, maths, reasoning, right, Logic, whatever it was, right? And the candidate did the bits and pieces, and HR called me and go, "We've got a problem." I'm like, "Oh shit, okay." His IQ test. I'm like, "What about it?" He's like, "He's really bad at maths." I'm like, "I don't give a shit." look at his design work. It's amazing. Like that's what I care about. Like this is that IQ test is for you. I don't care. But you do have situations like that where you've forcing everybody to do an IQ test just seems ridiculous.
I've never heard of that. Certainly the personality tests we get from time to time, but I've never seen an IQ test. But it is.
But the personality tests are bullshit. Like if you dig into the science, like there's no science behind the Myers-Briggs, for example.
I think if I ever went into a place and I saw that they were doing IQ tests and personality tests, I would just turn around and walk straight back out. Not because I'm high-minded, highfalutin about it, just because I know I'd be fucked on both counts.
But the Myers-Briggs thing, right? It was invented in
Is that the one with the four letters?
Yeah. It was invented in World War II by two ladies who took inspiration from Freud.
Right.
And it was designed for the army to assign jobs to conscripts or people who were being drafted for World War II. Oh, you're analytical. You're going to the post room or something. I don't know, whatever it was. You're direct. Congrats, you're a Marine. And that was pretty much it. It was just a quick fix for the army. And then it took on a life of its own as a thing. And then selling the training and the exams and the whole thing. But there's no actual science behind it, which blows my mind given how often it gets used and the variations get used.
It shouldn't blow your mind though, because what we know about, we've talked about diet many times on this podcast, bizarrely, but I've talked about how, you know, one bit of misinformation got out there because one guy shouted louder than everybody else.
Right.
You know, the myth of the low fat diet being healthy. It's accepted worldwide for no good reason. There is no reason to believe that the low-fat diet is healthy. There is no scientific basis in the low-fat diet being healthy, and there is no science backing this up. And yet, it's It's been around a long time.
Yeah.
One dude shouted a lot, and so we accept it. And it's just, there's a lot to be said for just sticking around. I used to work for a company, or I used to have a client, I should say. I'm not naming any names. I worked with them for 17 years. And they definitely, with the exception of me, I can honestly say, they definitely valued obedience. Sorry, loyalty over aptitude.
Right.
And it's amazing how many managers and employers don't want people who want to aim for the fucking stars. It's like, and they just want fuck. They just want mediocrity, and not in the true sense of the word mediocrity. They just want these, you know, turn up, do your job, go home, don't care. Sorry, I went all over the shop there, didn't I? Sorry about that.
I think it's valid though. A lot of these things are kind of psychological shortcuts. I think the personality tests, I dare say there's, in a lot of companies, they'll have them as a mandatory part of the process. We don't see as much of it as we used to. But if you asked every individual involved in the company, none of them actually wants them or cares. It's just it's a hangover, and it's of how they used to operate, and it's become the norm. I think I took one once years ago when I was going for a graduate program, and the results were that I tried to rig the test, and I hadn't, so I'd never trusted him since.
Psychopath.
Sorry?
Psychopath.
Well, yeah. That's a separate test. It's just a way of reducing the confusion of the world and say, you know, you've had a box mark test, they pass that and you feel a bit better about them. But I mean, any company, no matter how many rounds of interviews they do, and our record is 5 we've had so far, it doesn't really give you that much edge in hiring anyway.
There's no, like, are you really, I think where personality tests kick in, or where I've used them, where I actually like them, is if you've got a team, everybody on the team does one.
Right.
And then you have somebody kind of do a little workshop on communication.
Yeah.
And it's like, this person's an introvert, so maybe this is the better, you know, just making people more mindful about other people's preferences.
Yeah.
And just like tailoring your communication a little bit to them, or dialing down your energy, or dialing up your energy a little bit, or those kind of things, of just being more mindful. And I'll kind of like, okay, yeah, that works with a group, and it's kind of a good thing to do, and it kind of gets problems out in the open. Or, you know, I hate being praised in public is one I've seen somebody say, but I do like praise, but just do it privately and I'll get a lot out. Where there's another guy is like, I want a fucking trophy, I want an award ceremony, I want a fucking, like, you're gonna praise me in public in front of, like, that, I need that. So we've invented a trophy for it, just for him, just for that situation.
That I respect that quite a lot.
Yeah.
I once had a round of, I had 4 interviews for a job, and it wasn't like, again, it wasn't some highfalutin job, because I don't tend to get those. it was a good job, and I learned so much on this particular job, but they had me back 4 times, and 4 times I was interviewed by the same guy. And it's like, obviously I could do the job. I mean,
did he forget, or was he asking you different questions?
I think he was unsure about me as an individual,
or he was just hoping somebody else would say yes, and he's just stringing you along as the backup plan.
But he ended
up
paying all my train fares, which cost him a few hundred quid. But I think it might have been in the second one, because I turned up and I was wearing a gold tie, and the first thing he says is like,
power.
That is a very confident tie. And I'm like, well, I just think it goes really well with a shirt. I was wearing a really deep red shirt and a really beautiful gold tie. It's a good combination.
The 80s were a wild time, weren't they, John?
Well, the look that I was going for was, I've just left your house. I was seeing your wife.
Not in that shirt you weren't.
She wore it between really poor types. Is that?
But Fintan, she ironed it for me.
I guarantee you the cleaner ironed it.
What's wrong with that? It's a respected professional. I went to all these. I went to like 4 interviews, and I think it might have been in the second one where he said, so you and this is the only time I've been asked such a bullshit question at an interview. It was, You can have a dinner party. You can invite anybody from history that you want. Who do you invite?
It's a good question.
It's a shit question. It would have been a good question if he'd looked up my answers. Because I said a couple of contemporary people. I missed to give you an idea of the kind of time it was. I said Bill Hicks. Bill Hicks. Somebody odd like Don Coscarelli, somebody like that. My last one, I think it was my fifth one, I said Countess Elizabeth Bathory. And that was my one to just see if he was going to look these answers up. Because she was a Hungarian noblewoman in the Middle Ages who went on a lengthy trial. And this was very, very unusual in Hungary at this time, because Hungary was one of those countries where, you know, the borders were in constant redefinition because of all the conflict. Her husband is a national Hungarian hero, but she was completely mental. And she was on trial for killing her serving maids and eating them.
Nice.
And that was how I knew that he didn't look up my answers, because there's no way I would have got that job.
What gave it away is he invited you back for the third interview.
Well, I got the job in the end.
Funny.
You know,
what was the worst ones I got? I had to do, for Google, I had to do one of those thought puzzle things, like how many people are using Google search right now in the world?
Did you Google it?
No, it's a, luckily I'd read a book years beforehand that kind of explained that they're not actually looking for an answer. Oh.
Fenton, don't be angry. I can trim that bit out. I might do.
Well, it's quite obvious to see as well. It's quite.
Yeah, it really is.
When Paul starts barking, it's quite, it's quite straightforward.
Yeah, I did everything I could to loud racket proof this podcast segment, and postman dummy in. Sorry.
Don't worry about it. Don't worry. We will trim it out. We'll trim it out. We when I say we, John will trim it out. Yeah. He doesn't let me touch the audio.
Very wise.
So anyway, Fenton, you read a book.
So yeah, I'd read a book years ago, because it's quite a common American, at the time it was quite a common American company, kind of like, How Would You Move Mount Fuji or something was the name of the book. I think it was a Microsoft thing. And basically what they explained was, it's not about getting the right answer. It's about showing your thought process, showing your thinking process and problem solving. So it's like, so the tricks are like, just use estimates, use round numbers that are easy to divide, and then just think out loud and just solve the problem out loud to show that you're thinking and you're considering and all that kind of stuff. That was probably the worst one, because I'm not particularly good at like, if I had an Excel spreadsheet, I'd bash through it, but just doing maths in my head's just not really my thing.
The more ridiculous questions these days, you know, going back to the idea of candidates having the upper hand, if someone in an interview for a senior position says, you know, if you're to use one of your lines the other day, if you're a kitchen utensil, what kitchen utensil would you be? You're going to get a percentage of people just get up and walk out and say, if that's the level of questioning that you think's relevant, there's other employers who are going to be more fun to work for. It just doesn't fly anymore.
So here, that's a really, let me just sanity check. So I've got a question like that I use. I actually use two. So the first question is, what does our company do and how do we make money? Which just tests for, have you actually done any research before you showed up in here?
I'm thinking around it, yeah.
And you would be amazed the amount of people who haven't. The second one is, if you won the Euro Millions tomorrow, so you won the 150 million euros, so it's enough money to do whatever you want in the world, what would you do? Does that pass the test?
Central questions, yeah. It's a personality assessment, the second one. The first one's common sense for me. The second one, you're going to get a fair steer as to what someone's like, and surely everyone's thought about it. We do every now and again. But, yeah.
Well, as a recruiter, what's the shittiest thing you've asked somebody to do?
Well, go to the fifth interview for a start.
That's a big one.
And we don't do the interview. We'll have screening calls with people, but that's really just to check that they're A, committed enough to take a call or to be there when they're supposed to be there, and B, just to make sure they're not a Hungarian countess type character. So I don't actually do that much interviewing anymore, but it's letting people down is never fun either. And the number of jobs we get that are there 1 minute, and then you do the work, you get the candidates together, and then the job disappears, either because they've changed their mind or they've filled it internally. It's frustrating. Again, it's part of the business, but it's when you get somebody who's got their heart set on a job and then it just disappears. That's always a bit disappointing. But, you try not to think about it in terms of what we do inevitably has a massive impact on people's lives. And sometimes giving bad news makes it a real tough day or a tough week. Now and again, you get to put someone in their dream job, and that, that's kind of makes it worth it. But you have to disassociate yourself from it a bit, because it's, 90%, 95% of what we do is disappointing people, because not everyone can get the job.
So what about, so we've talked a little bit about from the employer's perspective of, like, don't be dickheads, good process, sensible questions, times have changed, move with them.
Yeah.
From the employee's perspective, even though things are like slightly more in their favor, particularly post COVID, what are the things you would recommend candidates to do? And I think there's two parts to this, because as I've gotten older, I've kind of gone through this journey. So there's the younger candidates who are in a different position, because there's typically more jobs. Like if you're in your 20s or 30s, but then as you get older and you get more senior, the number of jobs available for your seniority level rapidly start diminishing.
Yeah.
And it's a much, much different recruitment process, or like as a candidate, like looking for your next job. So what advice would you give the younger people? What advice would you give the people, the more seniors?
I'll start with a second one, because I think it's almost self-evident. It's all about networking, and particularly in a business the size of the gaming industry. My background is offline. Stephen is had a lot more online experience, but in both cases, they're not massive industries in terms of number of people. And really, at the very senior levels, everyone should pretty much know everyone else. So if there's a job coming available, the route to it isn't necessarily going to be to go through a recruiter, and certainly not just to apply. It's have a word with somebody. That's how we operate. Stephen in particular is incredibly well connected across the gaming business. And we kind of, one of our little sales pitches is any job that's available, any candidate, we either know them or know someone who's worked with them. And if you've been around for a while at a seniorish level, then you should have developed that kind of network as well. So that's critical. From the junior point of view, it's standard stuff, really. Research the company that you're applying to, obviously. If the classic approach is to try and connect with the recruiters or the hiring manager outside of the process as well. Not too obviously, but before you apply, perhaps try and make friends with them on LinkedIn or whatever. We find LinkedIn is an incredibly tedious thing to deal with, but it's also a critical part of what we do. We get leads off there. We pick up who's available, who's hiring, and so on.
LinkedIn was my secret for a long time. So what I would do is, back in the early days of my career, there was a magazine. There was a marketing industry magazine.
Oh yeah, Marketing Week would have been.
New Marketing, NMA, I want to say.
Not familiar.
Anyway, so there was these. So what I would do is I'd flip to the recruitment page, jobs page at the back, and I'd look at the recruiters who were recruiting. I'd look them up on LinkedIn and then add them on LinkedIn.
Right.
And then I had a very optimized, because LinkedIn hasn't improved much, but it was even easier back then. So a very SEO optimized LinkedIn profile. And my theory was that recruiter gets a job that I'll potentially be interested in the future. They bang in a LinkedIn search. And because we're connected and I'm optimized, I should be quite close to the top of the results,
yep,
which is more likely that I'm going to get the contact.
Yeah.
And that worked ridiculously well for like 15 years.
Well, any way you can get an edge, and anything that looks like or feels like some kind of personal contact is a route towards that. I think in nearly every case, as a candidate, particularly if you've applied for a bunch of jobs at a junior level and been unsuccessful, it's easy to think that it's a massive robotic process. And yes, you have the automated or the applicant tracking systems that process CVs and look for keywords and boot a load of people out because of that. But once you get down to the latter stages, it's all humans, it's all people. It's a cliche, but it's true that people are looking for reasons to thin the pile of CVs down. So, you know, a typo here, something about the spread of jobs that they don't like there gets knocked out. But if they know your name, even if just because you've sent them a message or a connection request, that's only going to help. And at the end of the day, it does come down to whoever's going to be your boss is going to make that decision. And again, another horrific LinkedIn cliche, the greatest job skill you'll ever learn is being easy to work with. And if you can give that impression, you know, I think any manager, if you give them the choice between someone who's easy to work with, makes your life, you know, he's a good person to have around the office, he's good fun and doesn't cause any problems, you'd rather have that than a pain in the ass who's 10% more effective at the job. What you spend most of your time as a human being in a workplace working with other people. If that's an easy process, that has a hell of a lot better than slightly more effective, but dickheads.
It's the no dickheads rule. Well, that's what that is.
I wasn't aware it had a name, but we don't use it on our collateral, but perhaps we should.
How does that work for you, though, Fintan? Just hypothetically speaking, asking for a friend, what if you're the dickhead?
I'm an entrepreneur for a reason.
I was just going to say, is this like a little bit like psychopaths outing themselves? Do you go to work for an entrepreneur thinking, oh, this guy's going to be a tool?
I think I'm a pretty good colleague. We'd need to check. I can't make that claim. Depends.
We're going to need independent verification.
In fairness, I can definitely be a pain in the arse as well.
I think only
if they're a shit manager.
The best managers I've ever worked with or worked for, they have that ability to be two different people. They're, you know, on the one hand, they're the person you share an office with or share a casino with or whatever, and you know, you see them from time to time, you might go out for drinks with them or whatever. On the other hand, sometimes they're the boss and they've got to tell you what to do, they've got to have difficult conversations, and they've got to ask you to do things you don't want to do. And the very best people I've worked with are people who can just do both those roles at once and switch from one to the other when they need to. And you know, think about naming names here, but certainly one of the guys I work with at Aspers who's still there at a very senior level is just fantastic at that. Just, you can sack people and still be friends, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do.
Who's that?
I'll tell you offline. Well, he's not going to have a go at me on the basis that I've just been praising him, but probably best to stay away from names.
I reckon I know who that is.
Okay.
I've always found ex-military have been pretty good.
Right. Yeah.
As managers, because it's just really clear. Like, I think one of the things I think particularly for officers and stuff was they're taught how to communicate really clearly. So they're very clear on what they want.
Right.
And that just works for me. If I know what you want, then I can go do it. It's very simple.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean. And I worked with somebody who'd been through, is it Sandringham? Is that the officer training thing in the British Army?
Sandhurst, isn't it?
That'll do. Oh, Sandringham's like a royal palace or some shit, isn't it? Shows how much attention I'm paying to current affairs. And, she didn't cause no end of conflict in the office, but she really put other people's backs up. It was really odd. I thought she was great. I thought she was lovely. And like you say, she said what she meant. But other people were like, but then it was a room of creatives.
I've got a trick for hiring creatives. Because you've got to see if they can take, so in my very simplistic world, there's two types of creatives. There's creatives who can take feedback. And there's creatives who can't take feedback. And so in the interview, you've got to test if they can take feedback in a piece of work they've done.
Right.
If they can't, that doesn't bode well.
So, Paul, with the state of things at the moment, so we've gone through the great this and the great that and the grand all this shit in the last couple of years, and things have changed a lot for recruiters and for workers. Now, Have you got any top tips for people who are recruiting? Like, I mean, is there anything that somebody wants to fill a position? Are there steps that they can take before they come to you that will help them to get what they need? Or are you just so fucking good at what you do that they don't have to? They can just turn up with a bag of chips in a bin bag.
Well, I mean, it's fair to say we're only as good as the brief that we get. You know, we like to think we can fill any brief, but as we mentioned earlier, if the brief isn't what the eventual decision maker wants, then it's never going to work. We're all kind of wasting our time. I haven't been through the recruitment process as a manager before, plenty of times when opening casinos. I know it's not fun writing job specs and sitting down thinking what the job's going to involve. You know, if it's operational, it's pretty straightforward. A pit boss does what a pit boss does. But if it's you're setting up a marketing team and this person's going to cover the creative side and that person's going to do the CRM, sitting down having a proper think about what that looks like on a job spec isn't easy, and it's not fun, and it's never as high priority as everyone else you got on your desk, but it still has to be done. And then, as we said earlier, communicating up and down the chain so everybody's on the same page, that would be the most important thing, but it's also almost impossible in a lot of companies, much to our frustration.
I do have one, maybe two late questions. Do you have any hilarious, offensive, or stories where you'd have to change the names that you could share with us?
Yeah, there's been one or two over the years. I mean, you would be astounded the level of job or the level of candidate who will just make absolutely basic errors. And indeed, turns out they just can't be bothered to turn up for interviews. We've had people for 100 grand a year jobs qualify for those jobs just not to show up. And you call them later, you know, you try and do the prep, you have a pre-call with them. I appreciate this isn't quite as offensive as you were hoping for, but we might get to that. they just don't show up. And I changed your mind. Did you? That's interesting, because of course it's a small industry. You know, we'll never put them up for a job again. If we get asked for a reference on them, to whatever means it's legal, we'll be sure to mention that. They're just astonishing. But yeah, we've had certainly way back when we opened a casino in the north of England, we had one guy who applied. He didn't like the fact he was interviewed by a woman, which was kind of a red flag to start off with. And after he'd been rejected, he emailed me, and this was during an incredibly stressful opening process. So I thought I'd engage back to pass the time and to have a bit of stress relief. And at some point, he referred to the person who interviewed him as some woman. At which point,
wow. Fucking hell.
You know, and this was a senior person on the team. And in fact, in the casino in question, we memorialized this. There's almost a plaque on the wall, which if I'm ever up there with you, I'll show you. Because it was just, and again, then tried to defend their position on a series of emails and just dug themselves deeper and deeper and deeper. Just, I mean, all of human life is visible to recruiters, and some of it isn't too pretty, I'm afraid. But that's part of our job, is to sort through the absolute cabbages and try and find people who are employable. Ideally, we do that before we even start sending CVs. We've got a bit of a list of people that we won't be placing anywhere anytime soon.
You're barking up the wrong podcast if you want to talk to people who are employable.
my favorite always is the wife applying on behalf of her husband.
Oh, really?
I've had that four or five times.
Really?
Wow. What? Yeah. And you're like,
what the experience?
So like she's done up a CV, she's written this cover letter, she's explained who she is, and you're kind of sitting there going, if your husband, like, you think, like, you feel for it, right? Because clearly there's other stuff going on in the relationship. Yeah. Here, right? So you always feel for it, but it's like, if he can't be arsed to do this himself,
absolutely.
Like, this is a no-go, unfortunately.
At least hide it and claim to be his PA.
Yes, that would possibly work. Well, if you've got a PA and you're applying for a job. But we've just been doing some, we don't do a lot of staff recruitment for casinos because it's, in the UK, it's virtually impossible now. So I wouldn't say we've given up, but it's very challenging. But we've just been doing some for a large, very large casino about to open in the Mediterranean. And we had 3,400 applications, I think, which make it challenging. Yeah. Well, we opened it up to everybody in the world, and there are a lot of people in the Far East in particular, who are almost no longer getting paid a living wage. So they're in a very difficult situation. But anyway, some of the applications you get for that are brilliant. I mean, you can obviously forgive people if English isn't their first language. You're going to get some communication snafus and so on. But we just the best one I've had so far was just a CV attached to an email, no title on the email, and the cover letter said, "I want job." It's like, fantastic.
We go back to the offices and efficient communication, I think.
Well, no keystrokes wasted there.
There's no messing about. He's obviously being charged by the letter.
Yeah, he wasn't in a cafe somewhere, but yeah, there's a. I mean, the kind of entitlement of the youngest generation is quite fun to deal with sometimes too. When you get people who've, you know, got a degree that they probably didn't really need and therefore think that the world owes them a living at kind of 40 grand first job. They're always fun to deal with, but we see enough of them.
I'm just sitting in my living room recording this and I'm just thinking about marketing because I've just seen somebody miss a great marketing potential there. My neighbors, that's the bumhole neighbors on that side, the passive aggressive bumholes.
Right.
That's on John's left for those that don't have the video feed.
They're there, but I'm facing out. So if you're looking at the house, it's the neighbors on the right. They've just had their windows cleaned. Not a euphemism. And like if I was that window cleaner or that window cleaner's assistant, I'd have knocked on my door.
Absolutely.
Because their house is immaculate. My windows are fucking filthy. If they'd knocked on the window, I wouldn't have even been able to see who they were. Surely that's they looking at me, they'd be like, this guy needs us. We need to show him how much he needs us. And they didn't. They've done nothing. They don't want my money.
But that's window cleaner 101. You leaflet you leaflet the street you're on and try and get more. Like that's well,
if I was them, I'd have cleaned one of your windows so it looked really bad for the rest of them. Then it's like it's really showing you up.
That's a very good shout. But also I'd phone the police and tell them somebody was assaulting my house. It's assaulting it with hygiene. How dare they?
Harvesting the grime you've built up.
Paul, have you been watching any series on any streaming services?
I am familiar with the Cobra Kai theme of the podcast. Sadly, I haven't caught up with it yet. In due course, I'm sure. Oh, look at that. The actual T-shirt being shown there. Like any...
Yes. It's my spiritual dojo T-shirt, the one that says "Bite like an eagle."
There it is. We're chewing our way through Happy Valley at the moment on BBC iPlayer, which is the jolly tale of a miserable policewoman in the drug-infested hellhole of Central Yorkshire, which is uplifting. But
I've just downloaded that. It's going to take me a little while to get to it, but I've just downloaded it because you know thought it'd be interesting. Interestingly, little fact that ties Sarah Lancashire, the lead actor, to my good self. Sarah Lancashire shot to fame in the UK as a star of Coronation Street, where she played a ditzy barmaid called Raquel. When Raquel got married in one of the TV events of the year, she got married to Curly Watts. My old school friend, Toby Haydock, he played the vicar.
Is this Doctor Who, Toby?
Yeah.
The other day. There you go. I'm listening.
Well, good homework.
You're listening more than I am, mate.
Yeah, Fenton's like, who's this Toby? I've never heard of him.
She's absolutely sensational. You would never guess that from being a kind of airhead character that she'd be able to play her.
But it shows just how good she was as Raquel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And as for Toby, he was terrific. Yeah, I'm just saying, I'm just laying that out there. He was very, very good.
Are there a lot of casting agents down at the podcast, do you think? Do you think he's...
I don't think so. But listen, so years ago, I was working at Canary Wharf. I was working for a well-known pornographer on Canary Wharf. And I phoned Toby. I was on my lunch break. What?
Were you like on the wharf like doing tricks or like were you...
No, a pornographer, not a pimp.
Oh, okay, sorry.
The terminology is very important. A fluffer would be working for a producer.
Right, okay.
Right.
Again, it's very different.
Pre-production, I think it's called.
Think suppliers, think marketplace. You've got to train somewhere.
Fine.
Anyway, so and I phoned Toby up to, you know, shoot the shit on my lunch break kind of thing. I was between clients. I was phoning him up, have a chat, and he was out. He was he was at rehearsals, and I didn't know he'd got a gig. And his lady friend at the time, she's a very lovely lady. She was like, oh yeah, he's got this new job, and he's really made up about it. It's going to be really good. He's in an opera. I'm like, he's tone deaf. He's actually tone deaf. Do they not know? They're like, yeah, it's fine. He's playing a mute. What a fantastic part!
Yeah,
unbelievable.
See, and now that is some good recruitment.
Well, yeah.
Anyway, I digress. But join us next time, not on the next episode, but in a few weeks, when we have Paul back to discuss the expansion of gaming recruitment solutions into Malta.
Hey.
Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Speak to you next time.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.